So today we're going to spend some time on Hebrews 7. So you might want to turn there. We're going to look at the last part of it. And then I always, for those of you that are new to the class, always like to have something that's applicable. And so as I announced to some of you in an email that went out yesterday, I'm going to talk a little bit about what has been happening in Paris. And we'll talk about ISIS and some other things and try to give you some perspective on what has been happening, because it certainly is a matter of great prayer. But we're going to spend some time today in Hebrews 7. Which is, again, written in large part, this particular chapter, to give reasons why the priesthood was needed, a new priesthood, because we had the Aaronic priesthood, the priesthood of Aaron, but then the writer, first in earlier chapters, and especially here in chapter 7, talks about the priesthood of Melchizedek, and how that pronounces a greatness of the new priest, and of course Jesus is the perfect high priest for a new and perfect covenant. So we're going to look at is the difference between first the priesthood of Aaron and Melchizedek, and how that fits Jesus, and then how that also is very important because we move from the old covenant to the new covenant. So turn with me, if you would, to Hebrews chapter 7. We'll begin in chapter 11 and verse 11. Now, if perfection had been attainable through the Levitical priesthood, for under it the people received the law, what further need would there have been for another priest to arise after the order of Melchizedek, rather than one named after the order of Aaron? For when there is a change in the priesthood, there is necessarily a change in the law as well. For the one of whom these things are spoken belonged to another tribe from which no one has ever served at the altar. For it is evident that our Lord was descended from Judah in connection with the tribe Moses said nothing about priests. This becomes even more evident when another priest arises in the likeness of Melchizedek, who has become a priest not on the basis of legal requirement concerning bodily descent, but by the power of an indestructible life. For it is witnessed of him, you are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. For on the one hand, the former commandment is set aside because of its weakness and uselessness, for the law made nothing perfect, but on the other hand, a better hope is introduced through which we draw near to God. A lot of things going on there, but let's, if we can, cover that fairly quickly, because it is easy to summarize. And this is, of course, we're seeing again that this priesthood that is being described of Jesus is superior to Levi. And of course, the question in the mind, which is exactly what the writer talks about, is that, okay, priests came from Levi. But we all know from Matthew 1 and Luke 3, the genealogies, Jesus came from Judah. And so as this is moving from one priesthood to another, from one tribe to another, but also from one covenant to another. And this new covenant is presented as superior to the old covenant. And, of course, here establishing this new order based upon Genesis 14. If you're taking some notes, you might put Genesis 14 in your quiet time this week. You might want to look back at Melchizedek, but we're seeing what is taking place there. And here is the encounter between Abraham and Melchizedek. And it sets a priesthood, basically, that the writer says, because there's a void of genealogies. Melchizedek is different than Aaron in lots of ways. First of all, he precedes Aaron. He does not have a beginning or end. We do not have genealogies. And so this is used as a type to recognize that Jesus is an eternal priesthood. You know, the Aaronic priesthood came and go. I mean, you were born in the tribe of Levi, but eventually you would die, and so there was a passing on. And if you would like to see a chart, wouldn't be a good Kirby Anderson talk without a good chart. Here's a chart that kind of maybe puts this together. And again, I don't expect you to write it all down, but the good news, it's on the website, PrestonWoodExamine.org. But look on the left-hand side here, we'll look at the Levitical order, and then on the right-hand side, we'll look at the Melchizedek order. And we see some remarkable differences. Levitical from Aaron, Melchizedek from Abraham. Levitical proceeded from a command. Here we see proceeds from a promise. We just talked about Levitical priesthood established by a genealogy. That is, you were born into the priesthood. The only priests that existed were of the tribe of Levi. Whereas Melchizedek established by an oath. And we'll see a little bit more about that in a minute. founded in the law. It was part of the Old Testament law. But now this idea of Melchizedek in the New Testament, especially tying it to the New Covenant, founded instead in grace. The idea of the Levitical priesthood be separation from God. And we'll look more at that in just a minute as it talks about how indeed the priests were always separated from God. And on one time every year, the Day of Atonement, the high priest only is the one that could enter into the Holies of Holies. But all the rest of the time, you are separated from God. Here now, as we're going to see in just a minute, we can draw near to God with great boldness. Then seeing again the Levitical order dependent on the behavior of sinful priests. By the time you get to 1 Samuel, you'll run into the fact that some of these priests were pretty despicable individuals. By contrast, when we talk about Jesus as the high priest, dependent on the perfect nature of God, the Levitical priests, of course, were based upon a mortal and temporal category. But, of course, here now we talk about the priesthood of Jesus, living and eternal. I hope that contrast helps you understand that we're talking about something very, very different. And again, if you want to have that for a chart, feel free to go to PrestonWoodExamine.org because that's where you will find that. Now we see that immediately after the writer of Hebrews, some people believe Luke, maybe Paul, that wrote this, now moves from the conversation of Aaron versus Melchizedek to a conversation of Old Covenant, now New Covenant. And if you think about it, the entire system of the Levitical priesthood, the law, the temple, the priests, the sacrifices, all of it were basically an attempt to show the need for someone to come and actually provide atonement. Because it was all really showing how far short we fall from the glory of God. Even this week when I was up there speaking to the Kennicott Institute, we got talking about this. And again, when you have all these college graduates, some of whom are headed to seminary, all with active minds, it is like a press conference for about 4.5 hours every day as they're asking all sorts of questions. But one of those obviously was the question of, you know, perfection. We got talking about different kinds of cults and world religions. And really, one of the things that I think one of the insightful students pointed out is, if you think about it, every world religion and every cult has to do two things. It has to minimize the holiness of God so that you can see how maybe you could work your way to heaven. And it has to minimize or eradicate the belief in sin. But here, the priesthood and the whole Levitical order was emphasizing the holiness of God, that God is unapproachable, that only once a year could a high priest go into the Holy of Holies, and then they always would tie a rope around his ankle in case if he just fell over dead, they could at least pull him back out because nobody else is going to go in and get him, right? And so there was a real tremendous evidence of the holiness of God. And then second of all, what did they sprinkle on the Holy of Holies? Something that had to kill. The sacrificial lamb had to be killed so that death had to take place, sacrifice had to take place in order for you to even consider approaching God. And so again, everything about the structure really prohibited individuals from approaching the holiness of God. Sadly, we live in a world today where not many people think about the holiness of God. I mean, you run into people all the time. If you've done any evangelism, a lot of people say, I'm pretty good. I mean, it's kind of the idea, God grades on the curve, you know. I'm much better than a lot of other people, so, you know, God probably is going to let me into heaven. And if you're going out on church visitation, as we've done here at Prestonwood, you get some of the most strangest answers from people. But again, it's all because they deny the holiness of God. But here we see that they could just only some people could even come to the holy place. And only one person once a year could go into the Holy of Holies. And so there was a strong emphasis on the holiness of God. Well, that doesn't give a lot of hope. But the good news is, as we read through here, that Jesus offers a better hope. He removes the barrier of sin and an entrance into God's presence. And so the Levitical priesthood and the law associated was a temporary provision. And now today, it is no longer necessary because Christ came. Which is something else we got talking about up at Kennicott, because a fair number of them have Jewish friends. And it is interesting. Matter of fact, one was saying in particular, I've done everything I can to witness to this Jewish friend. And they just can't see this. They want to live under the law instead of under grace. One of the individuals up there is having a tour of Israel. And for a couple of years, the tour guide he had was a Jew who knows probably more about the Bible than some of us do, because they have to study all this. And finally he says, "You know, I'm just getting frustrated with you. I'm going to go next year and I'm going to get a Messianic Jew, because it's just frustrating for our people to hear somebody knows this much about Jesus, this much about grace, this much about the life of Jesus, this much about even the day of Pentecost and everything, and yet stands there and does not believe." And yet here, those are individuals that still want to live under this law rather than the grace that we enjoy here as well. I thought there'd be some key verses that you might want to put in the notes there if you're taking some notes. One would be Galatians 3. And here, Paul is writing about those who kind of wanted to go back under the law. Isn't it interesting that as soon as we got grace, sooner or later, maybe it's our type A personalities, or maybe it's those people that are just convinced that you have to do something, they want to go back under the law. And here he says in Galatians 3, verse 24, "So then the law was our guardian until Christ came, in order that we might be justified by faith." And we see here in verse 19, when the writer says that Jesus is a better hope, there is this idea, he's a better hope, because even though we have the law, he is now a better hope. And as we will see in just a few weeks, I'm looking ahead now to Hebrews 10, verse 14. "For a single offering, he has perfected for all time those who are being sacrificed." So again, we can recognize that Jesus is the perfect sacrifice. Jesus is the king. Jesus is the priest. Jesus is all things. And I think that's really powerful. This perfection, of course, gave lasting access to God, something the Hebrew writer encourages us to seize time and again. There is a tendency sometimes for individuals, and this is another issue that I think is surfacing more and more, of people that accept the Lord, they become Christians, they walk the aisle, maybe they even are baptized, but then they said, "Okay, I got my ticket to heaven, now I'm just going to live my life." He says, no, you should want to get access to God. You have access that no Jew in the Old Testament could possibly dream of. When you go into prayer and when you access God, you have access to the Holy of Holies. You are in the presence of God as you pray. And we take that so for granted. So again, draw near to God with confidence that we might receive mercy and grace in our help in time of need. That fits very well with the message today by Max Lucado, doesn't it? You know, make sure that you're not still wandering in the wilderness. Make sure that God is in the center of your life, and make sure that you put down your Jericho and enter into the promised land. Well, let's move on then from verses 20 and following. We see a couple of other key points. And here it says, "And it was not without an oath, for those who formerly became priests were made such without an oath. But this one was made a priest with an oath by the one who said to him," and here again is a quote from Psalm 110, "The Lord has sworn and will not change his mind. You are a priest forever." This makes Jesus the guarantor of a better covenant. The former priests were many in number because they were prevented by death from continuing in office, but he holds a priesthood permanently because he continues forever. Consequently, he is able to save to the uttermost those who draw near to God through him, since he always lives to make intercession for them. For it was indeed fitting that we should have such a high priest, holy, innocent, unstained, separated from sinners, and exalted above the heavens. He has no need, like those high priests, to offer sacrifices daily, first for his own sins and then for those of the people, since he did this once for all when he offered up himself. For the law appoints men in their weakness as high priests, but the word of the oath, which came later than the law, appoints a son who has been made perfect forever. And so once again here, we now see that Jesus is the perfect high priest. He's described, as you could see there, I love this passage here in verse 22, he is the guarantor of a better covenant. You know, if you've ever taken out a loan, if you ever bought a house, you know what a guarantor is. And if you're looking for somebody to be a guarantor, isn't the best one to pick Jesus Christ? And there is the idea. And here we see, again, another quote from Psalm 110. If you go back, Psalm 110 says, "The Lord has sworn and will not change his mind." And this is actually in the context of a messianic prophecy. It's a messianic promise that you find in Psalm 110. And so in Psalm 110, you see God the Father swore an oath about his son becoming a high priest. And so again, this is something that's, I think, very powerful if you talk to a Jewish believer, because they will acknowledge that Psalm 110 is about the Messiah. But then it says God swears this of that Messiah, who is also his son. And of course, now in Hebrews 7, it completes the circle and answers that question. You know, it's interesting that in the Jewish tradition, the high priest represents God to the sinner. So there is one mediator, if you will, between God and the Jews, and that is the high priest. But now we only have one mediator between God and man, and that is Jesus Christ. I know our Catholic friends want to say that it's the Pope, but I don't think that that's what the scriptures have to say here. And here we see again, this says that now, through this high priest, the sinner can approach God. In the Old Testament, you could hope that the high priest would represent you, but still you could not approach God. You would hope that the high priest, in that Day of Atonement, would actually absolve you of those sins. But now you have this opportunity that you can approach him. And then we see in verse 25 that Jesus stands ready to receive us to save to the uttermost those who draw near to God through him. And so again, there's one other implication here where it talks about the fact that he is in constant intercession. Some people say, well, okay, Jesus is in heaven. He's with God the Father. What does he do? Well, there's a lot of things he does, but one of the ones we're focusing on here is this intercession. Salvation is done. Salvation has been accomplished, but the work of intercession is continuous. Isn't it nice that God is having an intercessor? That we have an intercessor, the Son, to the Father. When you sin, you know, Satan might be the accuser. We talked about Satan today, Max Lucado did. Satan accuses and the intercessor says yes, but it's already taken care of. The blood of Jesus Christ has already taken care of all of that. A key verse you might want to put in the margin there as well in your notes. 1 John 4, verse 17. "By this love perfected with us, so that we may have confidence for the day of judgment, because as he is, so also are with and in this world." And so again, we can actually approach the throne of God. We can approach Jesus. We can approach God the Father with confidence. And that's what he has accomplished on the cross. But as Jesus is, so also we are in the world. Jesus is holy and innocent. But we are then before God, holy and innocent as well. You know, if I were to ask you to describe how God looks upon you, I mean, our natural inclination is to say a sinner saved by grace, which is true. But we should also say that God looks upon us as holy. When he looks at us through Jesus and he sees us holy. Isn't that amazing? First Peter is struggling with that a little bit as well. Peter, I think, would have trouble with holiness, don't you think? You know, Peter always seemed to have a difficulty here. And in First Peter, it talks about the fact that we are holy, and it's kind of hard to imagine. And especially for a Jew, even more so, because what was holy was separate. Holy was something so completely different than what they were. And here we see that indeed God sees us as holy. Another verse you might want to put down, Ephesians 1, verse 4. Because here it says that God chose us in him through the foundation of the world that we should be, there's those words, holy and blameless before him. And then you could even go a little bit further in Ephesians 2:6, where it says we are seated in the heavenly places. So there are some great promises that we see in the Gospels. There are greater promises even in the various epistles. And of course, we see this promise here in the letter to the Hebrews. So very quickly, what I have in the bottom here was something I was going to cover maybe for an entire half an hour. But in order to leave time for the other presentation, I'm going to go through this fairly quickly. But as we have over the last 2 weeks looked at Hebrews 7, there's a couple of key principles. And the first is that Melchizedek is a type of Christ. I mentioned that last week, and I got furrowed brows a couple of times. People said, okay, what's this idea of a type of Christ? Well, there are various types of Christ and different other types in the Old Testament, but that does not necessarily mean equality. The priesthood was exalted and served an important function, and the priests were connected, or the individuals that actually connected God and the Jews. The Jews were connected to God through the priest. And I thought it was interesting. I was doing a study this week. The Latin word for priest actually means bridge builder. So the priests were like those who built a bridge. Of course, we have a bridge builder ministry here as well, don't we? We recognize how important it is to build a bridge to other people. But this is a building a bridge between us and God. And so Melchizedek is kind of a type of Christ. Doesn't mean he was Christ, although some people believe he might be the pre-incarnate Christ. Whether he was or not, he certainly is a type of Christ and provides an image of what Christ is. As I mentioned, on the Day of Atonement, the high priest would come and actually sprinkle blood on the mercy seat, and he mediated between God and man, and he was the bridge builder, if you will, between man, or in this case, the Jewish race, and God. You might put down one more verse, because we're going to get this in just a couple of weeks. In Hebrews 9:22, here the writer says, "Without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness of sin." In the Old Testament, we saw the shedding of blood of a sacrificial lamb. In our New Testament, we see the Lamb of God who shed his blood for us. God designed that sin would be paid for by a blood sacrifice. The priest made this sacrifice, as I mentioned, on the Day of Atonement. This is the bridge as well. And he is the mediator of a better covenant because we have a better hope. And in Hebrews 8, we will get to this next week, but I thought we'd look at it ahead of time right now. I love how it says this. Now, the point in what we are saying is this. We have such a high priest, one who's seated at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in heaven, a minister in the holy places, in the true tent that the Lord set up, not man. For every high priest is appointed to offer gifts and sacrifices. Thus, it is necessary for this priest also to have something to offer. And so next week, we're going to look a little bit more at how, indeed, Jesus fulfills that role as high priest of a better covenant. Then we also see this idea of Aaron's priesthood. What were the characteristics of Aaron's priesthood? And then we'll look at the characteristics real briefly of Melchizedek's priesthood. And the priesthood of Aaron was only for the Jews, and it was tied to the Jewish nation. So it was national, not universal. Number two, Aaron's priesthood was subject to the kings. A king could overrule what the priest might do, so in some respects it was limited. The priesthood of Aaron offered no permanent righteousness or peace, and Aaron's priesthood required continual sacrifices. But if you look at the priesthood of Melchizedek, you see something different. His priesthood was not national. It wasn't just for the Jews. It is universal. All can accept the gospel of Jesus Christ. Number two, it's not subject to royalty because Jesus is what? He is royalty. We saw that he is both king and priest. The priesthood was a permanent rule of righteousness and peace, first in our hearts, but eventually in the great millennium and in the new heaven and new earth. And then finally, of course, we see in Psalm 85, through the Messiah, righteousness and peace kiss each other. I love that phrase there. It's how righteousness and peace come together. So again, we can see some remarkable things that we've learned in Hebrews 7. But if you'll permit me for the rest of our time, I thought we might turn our attention to something that's an incredible prayer need. And at the end, maybe we can have a time, I don't know who, is EJ going to pray? Well, we'll let EJ maybe even put up some prayer ideas and things that we can do. But I think we've all been struck by not only the strike that it took place in Paris, 129 dead so far, 350 that are injured. But even a few days before, we had the attack in Beirut. We've had the downing of the Russian airliner. We have all sorts of examples. As a matter of fact, it seems to be somewhat spinning out of control. And if nothing else, maybe this helps us set our priorities a little bit. It's a little hard to really have an ongoing debate about Starbucks red cups, whether or not they have Christmas ornaments on it. This week I was in Missouri. It's a little hard to get real serious about some of the objections of some of these students at the University of Missouri, especially when you have an African-American student body president. You have all sorts of PC-oriented professors. It kind of puts things back in perspective, doesn't it? Now, I think we were all just shocked at all of this. These are just a few of the headlines that came out in both France and England, just reminding of the tremendous carnage and what has actually taken place and how horrific some of that was. If you're not familiar with this, let me see if I can kind of show this a little bit. I know some of you have actually been to Paris, and this will give you a sense. Over here is the Eiffel Tower. I guess we can't see it too well. Over there, I guess the green doesn't show up very well, you have Louvre, but a lot of those red dots there are where those attacks took place, and some of those were various suicide bombers. One of those individuals, they found his backpack, and he had actually come in as one of those so-called refugees. One of the others we've now identified, and he actually lives there and has been a French citizen, but has become radicalized. And so you've had both homegrown and those that have come in this massive influx of individuals into Paris. Of course, they have been going through the streets trying to pick up other individuals as well and try to bring some level of order. But I thought it might be important to begin to talk about who ISIS is. ISIS claimed responsibility. The French president, François Hollande, says that it was indeed an attack from ISIS. ISIS has claimed some of these others. And so I wanted to spend maybe a little bit of time talking about that. And to recognize, as I think this piece by Mark Stein puts it, the barbarians are inside and there are no gates. You always heard the phrase, the barbarians are at the gate. He says, well, no, the barbarians aren't at the gate. The barbarians are there, and there is no gates, and that's kind of where we are. And so this is the presence of ISIS in Europe as well. What to think about that? For some of you, if you've been in the class before, maybe a few of these slides are familiar, so I wanted to cover a little of that may be familiar to a few of you, but help others that are new to hear that. And perhaps one of the better books on the subject of ISIS is a book by Jay Sekulow. It's a New York Times best-selling book called The Rise of ISIS, and it's still available. It came out first as an e-book and then as a paperback, and you can find it on Amazon. You can download it in Kindle or something like that. But he really kind of takes you through the fact that ISIS at one time was associated with Al-Qaeda, but actually sort of kicked out of Al-Qaeda because they were more brutal than even Al-Qaeda in terms of their tactics. It is perhaps the richest terrorist organization in the history of the world because they've been able to take over so many of the oil wells, banks, and other things. They've been trafficking and sex trafficking and drugs and all sorts of things. It now has more firepower than any other jihadist organization because as it's taken over particular regions, they've been able to actually capture some of the armament that Americans left for the Iraqi army, but the Iraqi army fled. And so they are running around oftentimes now, not just in Jeeps, but in Humvees, and have a tremendous amount of firepower in that region. And they now control more territory than many nation states. Here is a picture of at least the current extent of ISIS. And up here you can see that there, again, that doesn't show very well, up in Mosul to the north. In just a minute I'm going to talk about Erbil. That's on the upper right-hand corner there. That's in what today is the Kurdish region. Some people have wanted to create a new country called Kurdistan, and Erbil is the capital. I'm going to mention that in just a minute. All the way down to Fallujah, and of course into the northeastern parts of Syria. And you can see the tremendous amount of land mass that they actually control. If you've had friends, relatives, family members, neighbors that fought in Iraq, you can remember the hand-to-hand combat and the loss of life of taking Mosul and Fallujah back from the various Saddam Hussein's army, and now to recognize that some of that is in the hands of ISIS has been so discouraging for those that actually served in our nation. Perhaps you've seen this symbol. If you go out on Facebook, you'll see this symbol quite a bit. And it is the Arabic symbol for the word or the letter N. And it's to actually symbolize Nazarene. That is that oftentimes as ISIS fighters have come into a region, they will mark the homes of Christians with this symbol, just as you might remember the Nazi soldiers would mark the homes of Jews with the Star of David. And so this has come to be kind of a symbol that some have actually put on their Facebook to show solidarity with the persecuted Christians in the region. So if you've seen that symbol, that's where that comes from. Let me for just a minute talk about how we ended up with ISIS where it is today. And this comes from another good book that I would highly recommend by Charles Dyer. He used to be one of our professors and our vice president at Dallas Theological Seminary. Went to Moody Bible Institute and has been there until recently. And this is a book published by Moody Press. If you kind of want to understand ISIS, this is a very good book. And I'm going to take some material just from one of his chapters in which he tries to give us the history of how we got to ISIS. And I'm going to cover this pretty quickly. If Charlie were here right now, he'd say, you went through this a little quickly, but again, just in the interest of time, let me try to summarize an entire chapter by what he calls five dots. The first dot is the fact that if you go all the way back to the 1970s, and those of you in the class that are a little bit older, you'll remember maybe in the 1970s when the Russians came into Afghanistan, and at that time, the fighters against the Russians were known as the Mujahideen. And there is a Rambo film about the Mujahideen. There's a James Bond film about the Mujahideen. So if you want to learn a little bit about that, those give you a little bit of a handle on it. But we actually were at least providing, if you will, intellectual and sometimes armament support of the Mujahideen. But one of those leaders was a man by the name of Osama bin Laden. Then that brings us to dot number two. That is, as Russia eventually left Afghanistan, there was an incredible power vacuum. And that vacuum was filled by the Taliban. Taliban is the Pashtun name for students. And these were students that actually studied a very radical form of Islam in Pakistan. And as they came in, they actually implemented this just brutal form of kind of Muslim fundamentalism. Women were no longer allowed to go to school. There were people that were executed for playing Western music or flying a kite. It was just a bizarre time in which that was the case. The leader of that was a man by the name of Muhammad Omar. He seized power and because of that allowed Osama bin Laden to establish a base of operation and build what many people then came to know as Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda is known as the base, and that brings us to dot number three. It's the Arabic word for base. And that's where then Osama bin Laden began to initiate various terrorist attacks. One against Saudi Arabia, another against our embassies in Kenya and Tanzania. By the way, we saw a killing just the other day in Kenya of all these university students in Kenya. I mean, terrorism is breaking out all over the world right now. And then, of course, the most significant one that affected us was happening on, what, 9/11. That brings us to dot number four, because then as we sent troops first into Afghanistan and then to Iraq, Al-Qaeda became kind of a franchise operation. We now know that Osama bin Laden was in a cave for a while and then eventually escaped to Pakistan. And as a result, there were various leaders in Al-Qaeda. The leader in Iraq was a man by the name of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. And those were the first beginnings of later what became to known as ISIS. As Zarqawi was killed, and this is now dot number five, killed in a drone strike, this power vacuum was filled by a leader by the name of Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. And he is the current leader of the Islamic State. ISIS stands for the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. Some call it, our president uses ISIL, which is the Islamic State for Iraq and Levant. Levant is a word used for the entire Middle East. It's a word that was used by the British. But nevertheless, we see today that we have this man who is pretty much running a lot of Syria and a lot of Iraq. And his name is Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. He was actually initiated as the Caliph Ibrahim, the caliph, the individual that wants to control not just this region, but eventually would like to be the caliph over a one-world Islamic government. And this was taking place in the mosque in Mosul. Notice the date, July 4th, 2014. This was their, if you will, Independence Day. Here's what he said. Fear Allah as we should be feared and do not die except as Muslims. Go forth, oh, there, look at that word, Mujahideen. Remember the Mujahideen? Those were the Islamic fighters in the path of Allah. Terrify the enemies of Allah and seek death. This is what he is saying. For the dunya will come to an end and hereafter will last forever. You might say, what's the dunya? The dunya is the Muslim word used primarily by jihadists that this world that we have right now is a false world. It is a Gentile world. It is a war of various, what's called the war of Harb, al-Dar al-Harb, which is the war, the house of war. And so this world that we have right now is to be replaced with a one world global caliphate where Sharia law is implemented on each individual. And so he wants to get rid of this dunya. If you remember this one individual that was attacking all of the military bases and individuals in Chattanooga, when we looked at his Facebook point, he said again he wanted to eliminate the dunya. So they want to implement a one world government with a one world leader. If you think that has some implications prophetically, you can certainly see that as possibly the case. One of the questions that keeps coming up is ISIS really Islamic? Because over the last 24, 48 hours, you've seen some of the leftist people in France saying, these people that attack, they aren't Islamic. You've had some of the Muslims there saying, no, we don't claim them as well. But I love this particular piece. Yes, terrorism has a religion, and it is indeed that case. We've had the president say this and others say that it's not Islamic. But the reality is, it certainly fits into a literal fundamentalist kind of interpretation of the Quran. And for just a minute, let's look at two of those verses. Matter of fact, you might want to read a Quran. I wouldn't recommend it for your quiet time, but if you wanted to learn a little bit more about that, you could read one of the chapters, which we're going to look at, Surah 9, the ninth chapter. There are 114 chapters in the Quran, 86 written during the time in which Muhammad lived in Mecca. Those are called the Meccan surahs. We have 28 written when he was in Medina, called the Medina surahs. One of the last ones written was Surah 9. It's not in chronological order like our Bible is. And Surah 9:5 is called the verse of the sword. What does it say? Fight and slay the pagans wherever you find them, seize them, beleaguer them, and lie in wait for them in every stratagem. Now, what's the difference between a moderate Muslim and a radical Muslim, how they interpret that verse? If you believe that that verse should be interpreted literally, and you believe that that verse applies to you today, you will most likely be a jihadist. If, however, as many moderate Muslims do, they say, well, that was a verse that related to Muhammad in his day, but doesn't necessarily apply to our day, then they make pretty good neighbors. So how you interpret that verse is really important. Let's look at another one. Go to Surah 47, verse 4. Here it says, when you meet unbelievers, smite their necks. Then when you have made wide slaughter among them, tie fast the bonds. Then set them free either by grace or ransom until the war lays down its loads. Now, some Muslims will say, well, that's not a good interpretation. I went up and looked at six different English translations of this verse. They all say essentially the same thing. I even took the time to listen to this, because you can actually listen to this in Arabic. And I don't know Arabic, but I could actually see how that was described and how the sections came together. And this is the case. And again, if you believe that that applies to this day, and those eight individuals in Paris did believe so, then that's what the case might be. Now, you might say, well, okay, that's, over there. Maybe we aren't going to be dealing with it over here. But if you look at the kinds of claims that are being made right now by ISIS, you recognize that they're not content to just fight this battle in Syria and Iraq, or just even in the European continent like Paris. Let's go to the ISIS spokesman, Sheikh Abdul Muhammad al-Adnandi. A lot of these names are kind of hard to pull together, but nevertheless, here he says that Western countries, Muslims living in Western countries, and that would include our country as well, are to find an infidel. But notice the phraseology here. Smash his head with a rock, poison him, or even destroy his crops. Where does that come from? I mean, you'd say, just go kill him, shoot him, right? No, these are allusions back to what? Verses in the Quran that call for individuals in that day to smash a person's head with a rock, destroy his crops. In other words, they're still using 7th century allusions to talk about the battle that we're fighting today. And so this is kind of what we're up against. What are their goals? You might say, well, maybe some Muslims will go around with them. Not necessarily, because ISIS says it's not just content with spreading jihad to Iraq and Syria, but they've also set their goals on higher targets. They have actually threatened to destroy the Kaaba in the Grand Mosque in Mecca. This is why the Saudis are not thrilled, because one of the greatest sources of income for Saudi Arabia are all the people flying into the world's largest airport, Mecca, on the Hajj or on the pilgrimage. They said, we will kill those who worship stones in Mecca and destroy the Kaaba. And if you notice, when ISIS comes in, they destroy every museum. They tear down any statue because it's all icons. And so this is a place where I think it illustrates a point that I make so often when I'm talking about on radio, and that is the greatest threat to a Muslim oftentimes is another Muslim. Is ISIS in America? Well, interestingly enough, this piece here comes from USA Today. Anxiety grows over ISIL's recruits in the United States. Don't take my word for it. The Secretary of Homeland Security says that they have now identified 1,000 individuals in America that have connections with ISIS, which I think illustrates that, you know, we may be able to fight this battle a little bit on a battlefield, but I think the ultimate answer is the gospel of Jesus Christ. To change the mindset of individuals that believe that they are going to be fighting in this holy jihad and bring about this great utopia where there will be a worldwide caliphate. And frankly, there are now more Muslims coming to Christ in the last few years than have come to Christ since the last, almost 1400 years. We're going to have, it'll be 14 centuries in just a few years since the establishment of Islam in 622. Pretty amazing. But nevertheless, let's see what others are saying. I quoted from the Secretary of Homeland Security, Jay Johnson. Let me quote now from the FBI Director, James Comey. And recently he spoke at the National Association of Attorneys Generals, and he said that ISIS is a chaotic spider web that avidly uses social media to radicalize people across the United States. He said before he stepped on the podium there, he had records of ISIS connections in 49 states, and at that point, just before he stepped on the podium, they said they'd now had some of those in Alaska. So now all 50 states, including Texas, we have investigations of people in various states of radicalizing in all 50 states. And this is the world that we find ourselves in. Now they're using more sophisticated technology. Many of us heard Johnny Moore speak here a couple of weeks ago, or months ago, I guess it's been now, and he was talking about how social media sometimes is used to radicalize these individuals, to encourage them. Whereas before, if you were going to be a jihadist, you'd have to go to another country like Syria, Sudan, Afghanistan, something like that to be trained. But now, indeed, that is the case. And here, one of the great concerns is ISIS is focusing on uniformed military and law enforcement. So let's, if we can, maybe for just a minute, talk about what can we do before we run out of time. And the first thing is, I think we need to support the police. This is a story where the German police actually found individuals that no doubt were heading towards Paris, but they found that they had AK-47s, grenades, TNT, and a lot more. Because they stopped them in a traffic stop, those individuals did not make it to Paris. So I think, if nothing else, we need to support our police force, right? And I just want to thank some others that are working right now in security. I want to thank you for the work you're doing as well. And I hope you'll say thank you to all the individuals, including the police officers, that protect us right here at Prestonwood. Everybody go up and thank and shake Dick's hand. How's that? Okay, that'd be one thing. But I think we need to do that because this is still a soft target. The only way it could not be a soft target is every one of us had to go through a metal detector, and that's just not going to happen. So, but the fact that we have this kind of presence, I think, is a real deterrence. So first of all, look at how the German police probably saved lives in Paris because they caught a couple of those guys before they could go down and blow themselves up or shoot other people. Number two, I think we need to protect the military. This is the list here. Seven different Texas states are listed by ISIS as their kill list. And if you look at those areas, they're almost all military. So if you have individuals that are serving at Fort Hood or a variety of other places, they're the target right now. They're the ones that are the targets. And so, again, this is a real concern. And if you want to see this list, it's a list all around the country of places that are on the ISIS kill list. You might say, how did they get that? Well, we're not allowed to divulge that information, but I think you can probably figure it out. And that, again, is another reason why we should certainly protect and support our military, because they are our line of defense. I think it's time to maybe check some of those refugees. This is our senator saying he demands that we put immediate halt to plans of bringing refugees with terror ties to America. Does that make any sense? It does to me. And we seem to have lost any sort of common sense about this. The president yesterday announces that they're going to have a station in Erbil, which is in Iraq, but it's actually in the Kurdish region, where they will check individuals before we send the 10,000 Syrian refugees that we're going to send over here. They're talking about the fact that we may eventually have 100,000 Syrian refugees. Now, for some of those, I welcome this country like we are a welcoming country anyway. But I think we've got to really start thinking about whether or not we just want to continue to have open borders. Isn't it interesting that the French president closed the borders of France? We seem to have difficulty wanting to do that, but I think you can see some of the dangers there. But at least this presidential candidate and others perhaps are talking about this as well, about rethinking this open door kind of policy that we have towards those who actually intend us harm. And, of course, there's a lot more I can say, but, again, it's noon, and we're going to head off to barbecue. And I'll sit with anybody who wants to talk about this over barbecue. Is that good? Because I'm sure some of you got some questions. But let me mention a couple of key books that might be helpful. One of the best books on ISIS is this book by Jay Sekulow. It is really easy to get. It came out in e-book form, so you can get it in Kindle and all sorts of other formats. And so if you wanted to read a little more about ISIS, and after this week maybe you'd like to read it, that's a book by Jay Sekulow. He's with the American Center for Law and Justice, and it's a really good book. If you want to understand a little bit more about the theology of ISIS, the history of how we got ISIS, and how we as Christians maybe even can witness to some of our Muslim friends who are not part of ISIS, this book by Charlie Dyer, published by Moody Press, really good book. And I thought I might mention my book, A Biblical Point of View on Islam. Many of you have a copy, and if you don't, you just give me your business card and I'll send you a free copy. Is that a pretty good deal? Because I think it's about time that we start studying this. And let's end with some kind of hope. What does Jesus say? And what do we all say? Greater is he who is in you than he who is in the world. And we live in a dangerous time, as Max Lucado said, an interesting time. Yes, it's an interesting time, all right. But I think it's going to be a matter of some prayer. So let me turn it over. Is EJ going to come up and pray? I'm going to let Parker and EJ come up here. But if nothing else, let's be praying about our nation.